I should remind you that there are musical selections which we're also working with that you may have forgotten about, and just because I don't mention it so frequently, if you don't have the sheet for the music, you can copy, Xerox a copy for yourself. For instance, in the magic we used Mozart's The Magic Flute, and for the interval between magic and symbols we used Alan Hovhaness's Fra Angelico, and now for art, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. If you don't have copies of these, we can make some tapes of certain excerpts for you, and you can get them here. I should think, though, that Mozart and Beethoven are available just almost anywhere, even in used cassettes and used records. One of the themes in art is a key which comes from the Greek heritage. Apollo is the god of art, or rather we should say that art stems from an Apollonian personality, which is somewhat different and more accurate. The central distinguishing mark of an Apollonian personality is that such a personality has a center, has a self, has a conscious center, a conscious self. Now there's quite a distinguished characteristic between Zeus and Apollo. Apollo is the hallmark of a conscious self, the ability to confer order, even on the most difficult, and especially on the most difficult of all conditions. Apollo can confer order on disease, by health, by medicine. Apollo can confer order on manic possessiveness, as in prophecy. He's the god of prophecy, he's the god of medicine, and also the god of the saving grace of the form of art. He is the head of the nine muses. So that the Apollonian sense of personality is that one can confer order from oneself, from the self, which one is conscious of, is a resource. So that in this sense, the Apollonian self is like a talisman. Is conscious, is able to radiate out, is able to work, to have effect. And its effect is the radiation of consciousness. That psychophysical energy, which is consciousness, which is able to be registered as a wave form, which has a definite manifest reality, is able to interface with the material world in a composing way, is able to make filaments of the material world and weave it into patterns, is able to reshape, is able to take the tree and make a bowl. It's an Apollonian sense. So that the self is a talisman there. Now, if the self were unconscious, as is incidentally usually the case, if the self is unconscious, even though it is there, it is only an amulet. It integrates, but it integrates in the sense of collecting. So that instead of having consciousness, one has a collective unconscious. And the only apperception of such a self by indirect methods would be that one has somehow a collecting unconscious centering capacity in the psyche. So that, for instance, the very positing of the idea of a collective unconscious is an indication of someone not being fully conscious. No matter how intensely you desire to be conscious, that's only aspiration. The achievement of it is an art, a techne, as the Greeks would use the word. It's a technical achievement. It's either done or isn't done. There are no halfway steps. Consciousness either is or is in varying degrees of unconsciousness. So that this exactness, this accuracy of the personality is actually made. Is made not in some mechanical sense, but is made in a kind of a, the Greek term was poiesis. You can think of the English phrase poetically made. It is a personal composition without the self functioning as a talisman in full consciousness. The semi-formed personality projects back its own deficiencies upon the inner center, upon the supposed self, and makes of the supposed self a thing. So that the incomplete person very often projects back and says, well, I have an inner person, even though I might not be here. In all my full capacity, I know that I have it inside me. And the colloquial wisdom is that I must rely on that inner self. Or if one takes it a step further in development, I must bring that inner self out, not knowing and not understanding the technique. That when you bring the inner self out, the personality becomes quite definite. The inner self is no longer there as a definite object, is no longer a subjective isolate, but is, to use a phrase, a focus of forces, nothing more and nothing less, which is to say a great deal. It means that the inner self has traded its projected objectivity for the projected objectivity of the person, and the person becomes that integrating center and is able to draw on the self like a talisman and uses one's inner self like a talisman to energize, to inspire, to give direction, but it is the person who makes the decisions. It is the integration there in the person which is important, which means that we have to take special care that we don't make the person the end all. We don't have an idea of the person as the inheritor of the self, the new self. This would make an ego-dominated situation extremely probable. I'm not sure what the probabilities are, but it's probably greater than 95 out of 100. So that even before the certainty of the person is arrived at, in the making of the self, there needs to be a quality of openness factored into the self. A quality of openness which factored into the self is then given to the personality, so that the personality is open. and has a similar capacity to the self to confer its objectiveness to another. One says colloquially, a really good person is someone who would give their life for another. What is the old Unitarian motto? No greater love hath a man than that he be able to give his life for another. That is to say, the center of decision making has an integral openness and caringness for others, and also for aspects of oneself that are not fully understood. We say of such a person who is open, then, the traditional word for it in many languages is spiritual. Such a person is spiritual. They are open to the flow of the Spirit and are able to give it as well as receive it, and are not particularly interested in holding on to spiritual energy, but respect spiritual energy as a flow that goes through them. It comes from elsewhere and it goes elsewhere. One can make use of it while it is here by cooperating with it, but it is always free to go. And so this openness of personality is essential. Now notice that there's a vast ecology here. There is a spiritual dimension which is beyond the person, one spirit. There is the open person, which is already a remarkable phenomenon. There is the deep self, which is a fantastic integration capable of giving itself to the person. And then, even before that, there are the elements, the ingredients that go into focusing and creating the self, so that one has an ecology that, if the salient phases are singled out, one sees that it is a four-phase process. There are four phases, and this is the old the Pythagorean Greek term, the tetrakis, or as the Latin translation of that Greek term, the quaternion, or as the modern 20th century Jungian vocabulary, which is actually more of a jargon, the quaternary. That is to say, the ecology of wholeness has a four-part structure. And each of the four parts are articulate from one another, not in the sense of exclusive, but in the sense of developmental, so that the processes between them are also four, so that one can, for instance, make an image in one's mind of a compass for civilization having a four-part stability at the cardinal points and having a process stability at an X on top of this four points. So that there is an eight quality to wholeness. Now, in the Hermetic tradition, it's called the Agdot, the eight. One can be very sophisticated and have a seven and not understand that the last openness is a part of the whole structure. And if one realizes that the last openness is a part of the whole structure, one moves, one jumps. It's almost like a quantum jump. One jumps from a seven to a nine. The Agdot in itself is like a fulcrum. It's like the fullness. But if one does not understand that the openness continues, that even when the eight occurs in its openness, part of its occurrence is further openness. And so the sacred tradition was always think of a nine situation. Even though the Ogdoad is the full structure, that full structure is still alive, still continuing, and thus one puts, with great understanding and compassion, the ninth in. For instance, in the Nag Hammadi manuscripts, out of all the Gnostic material that's there, there is a hermetic treatise. The eighth reveals the ninth. And if you read through that wonderful little discourse, and actually the translation by Louis Kaiser, a little known unpublished, well, it's published but it was never distributed in bookstores, and I have a copy of it here. His translation is just exquisite. The eighth reveals the ninth. And the hermetic treatise says that the eighth level is a level of silence. And in that silence, you hear the angels, the choir of angels, singing in the ninth sphere. And it's that kind of a quality that the completeness of the person, the achievement of the spiritual self, is achieved in silence, which allows for the completed form to appreciate that there is yet other beyond even its own completion. So that one has the prototype of the self in the mask, one has the self, one has the person, and one has the spirit. And in that four-part completeness, one would have what we would call, in the highest sense in our time, wholeness. Wholeness. It's become somewhat watered down because of New Age jargon, but I think it still carries the sense that we would wish to understand and enjoy. That wholeness includes all that is germane, all that is relevant, including the processes that have gone into the attainment. So that wholeness is not just all of the fingers, but includes the spaces in between the fingers too. The four fingers together would be a completeness, but the spaces with the fingers is a wholeness. And the ancient Greek way of expressing that was to clench the hand like this, not to make a fist of demonstration, but it meant, do you grasp it? The space in the fingers together. And in our English term still comes from the Greek original, grasp. Do you grasp? What do you grasp? One grasps the idea. And even in Sanskrit, the word is graha. Only in the Sanskrit tradition, one doesn't grasp the idea, one grasps the truth. And Mahatma Gandhi resurrected the ancient term satyagraha, grasping the truth. Who grasps the truth? The whole being. The being which includes the energized person, the deep self, the societal roles in the various masks, and the spiritual self. That whole being grasps the truth. Satyagraha. And in the Greek tradition, to grasp the idea. The older tradition was that you would teach by drawing in sand. Even, I must tell you this, that even in the schools, even in the urban schools and metropolitan areas like Athens, in classical times, the philosophic diagrams would be drawn in the sand with the finger. And then smoothed over to prepare for the next drawings. And the whole motion was that after one showed the students, these are the forms by which we integrate our meaning and carry that meaning to ourselves in our lives. And then the philosophic gesture would be, do you grasp that? Do you have that? Is it in you and in your life now? And If it was, then one would have learned wisdom. The knowledge was in the diagram. The wisdom was in appropriating the diagram for oneself. Wisdom belongs to the person whose self is a talismanic insight and whose spirit is capable of being free. Notice that the distinction between knowledge and wisdom is not a dictionary distinction. It's not on the basis of lexicography at all. It's in this enormous ecology of wholeness. And if one doesn't know that there is a strategy for being, if you don't even know that, one knows nothing, essentially. Whatever one knows has no place to be. Now, the mythic image of that was Dionysius. Fluidity. Protean capacity, but constant fluidity. Whereas the constant fluidity could even be incorporated into a form, which we could call constant fluidity, which we could then call a continuum. And that would be an Apollonian achievement. Notice that the edge is not that the Dionysian and the Apollonian are balanced evenly, it's always weighted towards the Apollonian. Because the Apollonian has that capacity to incorporate in its wholeness the fluidity of the other. But the other, with its constant fluidity, cannot incorporate the form into it. So that one comes to understand in the high wisdom tradition that reality is weighted towards manifestation. Even if the universe would be a dead even in terms of perfect balance between fluid and form, form would eventually, inevitably, always occur. And, or use the Latin term ergo, the highest form always will manifest. Given any conditional, in any universe whatsoever, God will occur. Inevitably, finally. It is a tremendous insight to be able to rationally understand that that is a true condition of reality. It's not made up by man. It's not a fingers-crossed hopefulness that, gee, I hope it is. It better be so. But to understand, in the highest sense of rationality, that the weight of dynamic is tilted towards the manifestation of the highest form. It will occur. Does, in fact, occur. The wisdom insight, if you have it in your deep self, is that it never did not occur. I have to put it in the double negative because that's the way it, realization has that kind of a quality. It's like the phrase, the shock of recognition, to recognize that there never was a condition when God did not occur. It's there's a lot of humility in that insight. Now this fluidity, this Dionysian fluidity, is the very essence, it's the tang of psychic energy. Psychic energy is fluidity itself. And in Euripides' Bacchae, the whole quality of the tragedy is that men who are immersed in an old order are trying to stem the tide of fluidity which is superior to their order, because their order is not based on the deep self, but is based on a ritual mask comportment to civilization. And of course, if you're basing yourself on that kind of a lower order of civilization, on the ritual myth level of civilization, psychic energy will dissolve you every time. Psychic energy is especially capable of dissolving ritual and mythic structures. So that the activity is one that we have to let go of the old worn out forms and go into the dissolution of the psyche and precipitate a new form which includes the living psyche. And the new form will be the person. Will not be the personality which is told what to do ritualistically by a mythic order of culture, but will be an individual person who has contact with their own deep self and who hopefully will have respect for the spiritual, the releasing of the spirit and letting the spirit be free. That kind of a person who is open not only to the deep self, but open to their own spiritual possibilities. Recognizing then, I think the classical form for this was the butterfly later on, that the fullness of the person is to let your spirit free, be free, to give up the spirit. And generally the wisdom tradition is that this is at the moment of death, not before it, but at the moment of death. One frees that life energy to be whatever it will be. One makes a gift of one's spiritual energy to itself. Go where you need to go. Be what you need to be. I relinquish any right to you. I relinquish any possessiveness towards you. Be yourself. And that was the culmination for life, is that one has this, and the Greek term was a beautiful death. Beautiful in the sense that one understood that the completeness of the form is to let that energy go, let the psyche be free. Let it be itself. It will, because it is superior to the person, it will be able to deal with it, whatever conditions obtain for it. But what impairs it is if the individual uses their power to try and hold it back. Then, in the classic sense, one gets a ghost. Now, it can happen accidentally. In Shakespeare, the phrase is, violent deaths leave ghosts. And it was the old understanding that if you didn't prepare yourself for this, inadvertently you might still be clinging to your spiritual energy and inadvertently create a ghost-like condition. It's the same thing, because it's the same psyche in Buddhism. The preta, the hungry ghosts, are psychic phantoms which are quite real because of the false ego sense of persons who are not completely open have kept part of that energy back. It's not enough to keep the person alive, but it's just enough to not to let it be free, and so it's chained in a kind of a watered-down form of the egotistic person. Hence, there in Buddhism, the accurate phrase, more accurate than in the West, is that they are hungry ghosts. Not just ghosts, but they're hungry ghosts. They demand that because you're forcing them to be, that you then take care of them. And of course, the thing to do is to break the illusion and let them be free to be what they are, and let the dead be what they are, dead. Yeah, and so there sometimes Taoism is more sophisticated than Buddhism in this sense, because the rituals of religious Taoism for exorcism are much more complete. If you ever need to have a real exorcism, a traditional Taoist priest is the most capable person on the planet of doing that. I remember personally seeing something like this in San Francisco on Columbus Avenue. There was a Trader Vic's restaurant, and four owners in a row suffered violent deaths until someone discovered that there was a Chinese owner previous to that who had evidently left some kind of a curse on the situation. And I was there with my mentor when the city of San Francisco, under Joseph Alioto, who's a very practical lawyer, Italian lawyer, sent a deputation to the Kuangming Taoist Society in Chinatown, and the old Taoist priest went, got his paraphernalia and all of his stuff and prepared and herbs and everything, and went through a public exorcism on the sidewalk of Columbus Avenue in San Francisco, and exorcised the place, and there was no problem after that. And it was a curious thing because you could see that in terms of Western rationalism, nobody believed in this, and yet one could see in kind of an eerie intuition that this did it. And so you were confronted by what we call in the West a mystery. And as Alioto said in a press conference, he said, "Who knows, but we have to cover all the bases in a town like this." And it was a beautiful way to phrase it. Everybody could then sort of adjust to the fact. But my professor said that this was legitimate. And because I was in training, explained and went through the whole process of the efficacy and why this is so and how this is so. And so you can see that the person has a precariousness, needs to be fulfilled, needs to be achieved to the nth degree, but part of the nth degree is to keep the openness a part of the personality. So however highly energized one becomes, and one can become quite energized, one can achieve a integration of psychic energy which approaches 100%, which is really something. We usually work with, 5%? 7%? If you get on, you get up to about 10%, so you can imagine. I don't know if you've ever seen an achieved yoga karan, but it's really something. Talk about radiation. Why? They have all of the power that a deep self would have in their personality. In India, one would find individuals like this occasionally, and they would be, in the English phrase, God-struck. Ramakrishna was one of these people, whose personality was that of the deep self. Or Ramana Maharshi would have been someone like that. It's an odd kind of a quality. But we can appropriate for ourselves, for our person, a great deal of this, maybe not 100%, like a disciplined yoga karan, like a Buddha or a Christ, but we can have a great deal of that energy, a great deal of that psychic energy integrated and available. I should think 70 or 80% would be quite normal. In traditional history, in religious communities that really worked, that would have been probably the norm, somewhere around like that quality. The key is to understand that the self makes an adjustment from being an amulet of collecting unconsciously to becoming a talisman to being able to radiate consciously. But notice that shift, and it's not so much a transformation, but it's like, I have to use the old phrase that was told me, it's like shifting the balance from one foot to both feet. One goes from a slight imbalance to balance. sort of a low class understanding of this is like the Tai Chi exercises. It isn't bodily posture. It's self-being that comes into balance. That the body is in balance is a minor indication. It's symptomatic of this other, which is structural. So that the self moving from an amulet, a collecting, unconscious quality, to a radiating conscious quality, a talisman, is exactly the shift that occurs in reality in its weightedness towards manifestation occurring. It has the same quality, and because of that, the experience has always been, I think, referred to in wisdom traditions as participating in the creation of the universe. Because coming into consciousness that this has occurred in oneself, one can see that indeed this is the sine qua non of reality. This is what makes reality real, that this does in fact occur without anybody pushing it, without anybody hoping it's going to happen, without any kind of gambling probability that will it happen, that it does, in fact, in a very natural way, using nature with a capital, in a natural way, this does occur. Because reality has this tone of weightedness towards manifestation. And one can understand, then, why there is such a thing as the universe. It doesn't need to have some kind of incredible design behind it, you see. That's egotistic. That's an egotistic projection. Whereas the religious humility is that this is the true nature of God, that this occurs in His nature, that this is all real and not an illusion in that sense at all. The illusion was that there must be some plan behind this which I can discover if I just power myself. That's the Faustian kind of quality, you see. That's still making the devil, in the Faustian sense, want the deep self. Oh, he'll give me what I want. I'll just make a deal, and then I'll find some way out of the deal. Well, there is no such thing. There is only in the sense that one, in a delusive quality, believes that there is, and that quality of belief can go a long way in this kind of a world towards having it occur, because it makes it an autonomous psychic energy construction, but rather on the same level that ghosts are, or hungry ghosts, occurs in the same way. If one takes away the nutrition for such creatures, that is the continued delusion, they no longer, not only do not exist, but they don't even occur. One understands that they never did exist in the way that the deep self exists, in the way the person exists, in the way that the spirit exists. They never did exist in that way. How does the deep self exist? How does the person exist? How does the spirit exist? Not as something objective, but as all things possible. And so I think Ibn Arabi, in The Journey to the Lord of Power, one understands that you don't have to be the Lord of Power. You are the Lord of Power when that occurs. It's not a role which one appropriates for oneself. It's an occurrence that happens and you're in harmony with it when it does go on, when it's happening. So that, to put it in psychological terms for a second, instead of there being an existent, there is existence. Instead of there being an experiencer, there is experience. The experience is real. The experiencer is always temporarily occurring, is always gratis of the experience. Because the experience comes together, there is always the token sense that there's an experiencer. In really refined analysis, the experiencer does not occur, but the experience does. The experience is quite real, but the experiencer is only temporary, as we would say. Or, if you like to be skeptical about it, problematic. The kind word is problematic. It's like the Buddha would say, don't worry about the Atman. Don't be overly concerned about the Atman. If the Atman is what it's supposed to be, then it'll take care of itself. Your only concern is with living right, speaking right, thinking right. Your concern is with these. This is enough to occupy a human being in their life. The Noble Eightfold Plan is plenty. It'll keep you busy 100% of the time. So don't worry about the Atman. There's nothing you can do about it anyway. And so when they would ask him, well, does it exist? Does it exist? He would always, in his way, say, its existence is irrelevant and extraneous to your problem. Your problem is to live right by thinking right, speaking right, right occupation, and so forth. In other words, the emphasis was on the structures of the quality of experience, and don't worry about what's going to come out of that. That will take care of itself. If you purify your experience in this sense, whatever else needs to be purified will. Will of the accord of that process. Can you understand that art then is person-making in this broad sense, and that it has a kind of, by using a Greek mode, it has a kind of an Apollonian quality to it? This is why Apollo is always associated with art. Zeus is the king of gods in mythology, but Zeus is effectively challenged by Dionysius in the magic of psychic energy and dethroned. The whole Olympian order is dethroned by Dionysius. But out of the very flux of the Dionysian magic psychic energy comes Apollo. It's a very odd kind of a sense. Now, I don't have it listed down here, but one of the very, very wonderful musical presentations of this is Stravinsky's ballet, Apollo. If you get a chance to hear it, I have a record of it here, and you can make a tape for yourself. And even though it's not our musical example, if you put together Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring and Stravinsky's Apollo, you can see what an enormous development in consciousness Stravinsky underwent in his lifetime. Unbelievable genius. Stravinsky is one of the great musical minds of all time. In The Rite of Spring, he shows that he understands the ritual level perfectly. And in Apollo, the ballet Apollo, it shows that he has mastered art as a musician. And the ballet, even just its musical score, but the musical score with the dance appropriate to it, is unbelievably great. It's one of the great achievements of the 20th century. Just in this way, our materials, Kandinsky, Henry Moore, Euripides, and Frank Lloyd Wright, are four approaches towards trying to get perspectives on what I've been talking about for this first 40 minutes today. From sculpture, from painting, from poetry, from architecture, which we have translated into our mask assignment, our second mask assignment. These are four perspectives. Now notice that this four-part structure is consistent with the four-part nature of the wholeness of the self. So that if one looked at the wholeness of the self